I've been building blockchain systems since 2013. I built the very first permission blockchain. I've been building smart contracts since before Solidity existed. What does fascinate me is two things. Monex, where we are, is on a mission to make NFT transactions safe, secure, and legal. And in order for the entire industry to get that sort of next big wave.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode on the Tokenize Show. We have a very special guest today. I'm very, very excited. Today's guest is Casey Kuhlman, the CEO of Monax Labs. Thank you so much for taking the time, Casey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, so let's get right started, Casey. For everyone who doesn't know you that well and doesn't know what you guys do at Monax, could you give us a brief introduction about yourself and about Monax Labs, please?
Sure. I've had a windy road to where we are now. We are working as Monax Labs with the mission to make NFT transactions safe, secure, and legal. And so we've got a number of things that we're doing in that dimension that are, we think, new and unique in the NFT space. But I got here through a relatively windy road. So my first career was in engineering and structural engineering in particular. And then after I had done that degree, I decided rather than build things that I would blow them up. So then I was an infantry officer in the Marine Corps. Then after that, I went to law school, and then I did law for a good while, including time in East Africa, where I worked on war crimes tribunals, and West Africa, where I did governance reform work. And it was while I was in East Africa, where I had been very interested in the idea of the computers running the contracts. So when the very first smart contract compatible blockchain design started to be theorized, I fell down the rabbit hole relatively quickly. And since that time in late 2013, I've been building at the intersection of legal tech and blockchain tech since then, and to the point where we are here today at Monax Labs.
Wow. So basically, you've been into crypto very, very early then, right? We're talking about 2012, 2013, right?
13, yeah. I'm the class of 13. Yeah, exactly. Late 13.
And what exactly made you, you don't really have that IT background, right? You studied at the law school. How did you even hear about the crypto and Bitcoin in 2013? And how did this move into crypto start?
I've been a programmer since I was six. So I built my first little tiny program since I was six. And ever since then I've been programming. But that's neither here nor there to the story of sort of how I stumbled upon crypto. I had stumbled upon crypto because like I said, I was in East Africa, and I was at the time running my own law firm there. And one of the challenges that we had was getting money into the country, like just functionally getting it there. I mean, I had clients that were like multinational corporations, and I was in a place in Somalia, and I couldn't exactly ask like a multinational corporation that was my client to have their finance team take a wad of cash down to the weird part of town and find the remittance people and then like send me the money. And that wasn't going to work. I had built a mechanism where I had bank accounts in different places, and then folks that could, you know, basically using online banking and other things, I was able to craft a solution. But the solution was right in the middle of that solution was a large multinational bank that provided essentially wholesale services for the remittance companies. they were looking to offload remittance companies. And this was at the time where Bitcoin was being theorized as a solution for remittance problems. And so because of that, I was like, oh, okay, well, let me check this out as a way to hedge against like something bad happening with my existing the structure for how I can get money in and out. And I realized really quickly that that was just not, it was nonsense. It was nonsense in terms of like, this could actually do anything for me today. I mean, in theory, if everybody has, you know, mobile money wallet and that's connected to your Bitcoin and you can like easily transfer from your crypto wallet to your mobile money wallet, okay, maybe, but like that wasn't the reality at that time. And it's not really the reality today. So because of that research, coincided with the time when the Ethereum white paper had just been published, and that to me was extraordinarily interesting. And so for me, I've always been a legal and process person, much less so about like finances and payments. I've never found those intellectually interesting. So I never found the whole like stream of Bitcoiners and that are worried about like inflation risks and needing to have a like monetary supply that is fixed by an algorithm. I never thought that was really interesting. Right. I didn't really care about like Bitcoin as global gold or global cash. Again, for me, those weren't really interesting lines of thread. But when the first system that could do like computational units across potentially adversarial computers came along, to me that was super fascinating, and so I fell down the rabbit hole then.
All right, so we know how you got started into crypto, and how did it all start with Monax? Could you dig down a little bit and tell us about how did it begin? What's your mission? What is your like next goals that you want to achieve in particularly?
Sure. So, like I said at the beginning, Monax, where we are, is on a mission to create to make NFT transactions safe, secure, and legal. And in order to do that, we have two platforms that we are building. One is called Aspen. That is an NFT transactional platform that allows folks to buy, sell, swap NFT transactions, just like many marketplaces, but also allows them to add legal hooks into those transactions, number one. And then number two, it provides advanced data analytics that you don't really find within marketplace applications. And then number three, it allows folks to treat their NFT assets from a kind of property management or a portfolio management position. So if you have, for example, PDE assets, you can stake, unstake, and claim those assets in the application, as well as buy, sell, swap, as well as get glean data analytics around those. And so that is our secondary marketplace. And then we have a minting engine, which is really focused on how do we create NFTs that have a few kind of re-architected things at the core of NFT architecture that allow us to much more easily put in some legal hooks that we need to have in order for the entire industry to get that sort of next big wave of intellectual property holders and as well as collectors.
All right, and how did your journey with NFT start? What was the exact moment that you heard about it, and what made you so hooked?
The moment I heard about NFTs was I guess probably the idea of what we currently call NFTs was way before we had the idea of NFTs would be a name. So it would have been the Imogen Heap. What was her name? The artist that released music with Ujo in 2015. I think it was Imogen somebody. That was the first moment. The first music drop was, I think, the first time that I ever had cognized what may turn into or what eventually did turn into the NFT industry today.
And were you immediately excited about the whole idea and the technology, or did you dislike it at first? Because 2015 is very, very early, I think. Like most of the people, when they heard about NFTs, was like around 2017, probably something like that.
We didn't even call them NFTs in 2017, I don't think. Maybe by 2017 we had coined the term. But in any event, I was very neutral. Like there's a range of use cases for blockchain technology that are interesting. And largely you need a fungible token or you need a non-fungible token. I mean, it's like, it's the uses of the technology are so broad. I mean, essentially what we're talking about is just a little digital piece of property that has a particular ID number on it. And so like the fact that it happens to have a picture of a cartoon animal on the inside in a way that computers say this is the NFT, that sort of happenstance. That's not really integral to the design. I mean, that could equally, as we all know, be a video, or it could be an audio, or it could be it could be an access pass to a concert. It could be really anything. And so it's extraordinarily broad, and that's how I've always viewed it. Like since the day, I mean, I remember when they released that album, I thought that's great. They're releasing an album. The problem they're going to have is that you can't really do anything unless you already own all the way down to the ears. And over time, we've kind of understood that that is reality, at least in the audio space or music space, that you have to own down to the app level in order for that to be a viable line of business. Doesn't mean that like music NFTs aren't interesting or that they won't take off, but it just means like you're going to have to build in these areas in order for this to really take off. So I've always been really interested in the generalized technology. And I think one of the things, but that said, one of the things that has been very interesting to me over the last 12 months, let me say, is that it's become increasingly clear that if you want to compare sort of DeFi or even meme tokens or like L1 tokens or some of those things, if you want to compare those to NFTs and apply them to the question of what is it going to take to get us mainstream, there's no competition whatsoever in my mind at this point. Like it's clear to me that that what we currently call the NFT side of this blockchain ecosystem is what will be the gateway drug to mainstream adoption of like generalized blockchain technology. And I'm increasingly more convinced of that by the day. So I'm pro NFTs as we call them today. And it's been a fun journey to watch everything explode over the years. I remember going to very early conferences where you would have the art people at the conference just sort of over in their own world, not really integrated into the mainstream of the conference. And now, now those people are running their entire very large conferences. So it's been great to see that bit of the ecosystem explode over the course of the last 12, 18 months.
Yep. So talking about Monax Labs and the Aspen platform, in what ways are currently the NFT, the non-fungible token transactions on the blockchain, in what ways are they not safe and secure? Or if I ask differently, in what ways do you guys make these NFT transactions more safe? I mean, safer and more secure?
Yeah, let me focus more on the legal side. The safety and security is more around how a user feels when they use a platform and what experiences you give that user when they are interacting with the platform. For example, we will be, but one area in this, one example of in this area of a feature that our platform will be supporting is a user to be able to pre-register essentially alternative wallets And then when you know that you have a wallet compromised, if you have a pre-registered emergency wallet, we're going to have a means for you to evacuate out all of your meaningful all of your NFTs from one wallet into another in a way that doesn't require you to have any ETH in the wallet. So this way, you know that you have at least one mechanism to potentially get NFTs out of a compromised wallet. We have a few other features that will be in this dimension, but the real difference is on that third, is the real architectural difference between what we're doing and what others may be doing is around the third word there in the legal. And this comes in predominantly two dimensions at this stage. So the first dimension is when is around the terms of use of a particular NFT. So today, when you go to buy an NFT, if you buy it on OpenSea or pretty much any platform, at some point in the buying process, you're going to be asked to tick a box, you agree to the terms. And then you're going to push a buy button, and it's going to pop MetaMask, and you're going to, you know, sign your transaction and send your ETH, and you're going to get your cartoon animal or your piece of land or whatever it is that you buy. Great. The problem, there's a couple of problems there when you really think about it. First off is, what are the terms of use that you ticked, and who are they protecting? Are they protecting you as a buyer? Are they protecting the creator, or are they protecting the seller? The answer is it's protecting none of the three. It's protecting the platform on which you're buying. It's a pretty standard, way in which the platform is protecting itself in case something weird happens. And so in that buying process, what are you not doing? What you're not doing as a buyer is agreeing to the terms that the creator has said need to be embedded or kind of govern this NFT. Now, people say, for example, that there is a difference between, used to be a difference between punks and apes around the quote unquote licensing. If that had ever gone to court somehow, in most courts, I think that there would have been people would have found very different outcomes than they expected. And the reason is that neither side would have been right, because essentially, there was no linkage between a document that says these are the terms of a license or these are the terms of use and the NFT. And in order to actually have this linkage between your terms and your NFT, you need to have evidence that someone has read and agreed. And this line of thinking comes from it comes from when we used to buy the computer software in boxes at the mall. And it is the reason why when you sign up to a new website, you have to nearly always scroll to the bottom of a long list of legalese and actively push the button that says, I agree to these terms, and then click, I accept. And you have to take those actions. And there's two sides of that. First, you have to be shown. And second, you have to collect evidence that someone has agreed to those terms. And if you don't have that evidence, essentially what a court is going to end up doing is it's going to apply some legal default, whatever that legal default is. And so what basically every NFT on earth for the most part has done incorrectly, in my view, is not architected themselves in a manner that allows the creators to actually link their terms and whatever they might want to do, whether that's permissive or restrictive, is completely irrelevant to this discussion, because legal defaults are somewhere in between the two. And but right now, from an architectural perspective, because there is not a box when you go to buy an NFT that says, I agree to the terms of this NFT, and you click that and then you push buy, right now, basically anyone that has said they have their terms of use over on their project's website I'm pretty sure most courts will largely ignore, if not completely ignore, every single bit of that. So that's one of the big problems that we solve. And then the other one is around ownership. So in the NFT space and blockchain space more generally, we have this idea that if the NFT is in your wallet, then you own it. And I put air quotes around in your wallet because that's all just a like function of how wallets sort of are architected. It's never really in your wallet per se. But the reality is when you say that something is in your wallet and therefore you own it, you have complete control. And this leads to suboptimal outcomes in a number of dimensions. It means that it is exorbitantly hard to trustlessly lend an NFT to somebody else for some reason, or lease them an NFT for some reason, or to get a mortgage on your NFT world so that you can afford to build the game that would look really great on this thing. A number of higher level commercial transactions that we have in the real world and folks would love to implement in the NFT space are fundamentally challenged. And because we have architected NFTs in a way that has conflated the ideas of ownership and the ideas of possession. So if it's in my wallet, I own it. Means I can sell it, means I can do everything that an owner would do, is a little bit of a, it's a very limiting point of view if you want to build higher level commercial transactions. And so the other thing that we're solving is more cleanly separating the ideas of ownership and possession so that we can build higher level commercial transactions at scale.
So, on user side, let's say that I wanted to buy an NFT and it would have all the legal stuff set right, as you said. Mm-hmm. Would it like the only difference be that I would be ticking one more box, or is it way more complex? I mean, obviously on your side, it's way more complex, but on user side, it's just a box and that's it.
Yep.
Wow. I mean, that's insane because like all the problems you described, you can basically solve with just clicking one more button. But what happens if your project doesn't have their own terms of service, etc.?
I mean, if you don't have your own terms of service, then it's the same as if you're Yuga Labs and you paid fancy lawyers a boatload of money to write you a license. In my opinion, it's going to be the exact same result. Courts are just going to apply some default in there. Because things haven't been properly linked, but had they been properly linked, then, you know, maybe paying lawyers a decent amount of money to build you a fancy terms of service is going to be something you would want to do. But until you get there, until you properly link the two, that's just going to be a waste of money.
Right, I got it.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't really thought about it that way. Just out of curiosity, is there any other company out there that is doing something similar like you guys, or are you the only one?
There are a couple of people coming at pieces of the problem. There are, for example, companies that are building trustless lending of your NFT, and that's all they're doing. It's just like, I'm going to lend it to you type thing. And but in my opinion, the whole thing you need to go like right into the guts of a typical NFT smart contracts architecture in order to solve these things correctly. And so we're the only ones I know of that are probably going this deep and essentially saying to the marketplace, it's time to upgrade our systems if we want to do anything more interesting than having the same 200,000 wallets trade cartoon animals back and forth.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most, I mean, the problem you just described before, most retail users aren't really aware of that problem. Am I right?
It's not really a user problem. It's a creator problem.
All right. And most of them aren't really aware. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, how would you?
A lot of creators that are currently in the blockchain space are definitely not aware of these. Although there is a massive amount of intellectual property that would be very interested in participating in the NFT ecosystem that is currently standing on the sidelines for largely three reasons, of which this ability to have your terms of use is one of the big reasons. And so because of that, like, there's a massive amount of, you know, intellectual property that we that people will know globally that is not currently playing in the NFT ecosystem. And you know, some of that is like, oh, we don't like NFTs, or it's very sort of passe, you know, objections to the entire crypto industry, which I don't particularly think is that interesting or relevant. But some of it is like very concerned about the fact that, you know, we own a bit of copyright, a bit of intellectual property, and maybe cool to make some NFTs around that, but we also have like obligations to others via contracts that we have signed for however many years that require us to do and own and pay things in a particular manner, and without an ability to then move that into some sort of an NFT thing or constraint within the system, current intellectual property owners are just largely standing on the sidelines waiting for these to be fixed problems, and then it will be much more interesting for them to participate.
Yeah. And for creators, what would be the biggest pain for not having such terms of service for their NFT project? Like, what's the worst thing that could happen because of it?
The main thing is, I mean, what's the worst thing? There's a bunch of worst term outcomes. It's always funny.
We can talk about
it. I always find it, ask a lawyer the worst possible outcome, because lawyers could get really creative around that. But like, in general, the bad things that will end up happening potentially are that you your intellectual property is used in a way that you did not agree that it could be used. And that may sound like a small deal, but to a lot of artists, that is not a small deal at all. In fact, that's just like completely messing with their livelihood for how a lot of artists think about like the production of their art, you know, is that the way that you can use and or reproduce and or, you know, create derivatives around whether I'm saying you can or cannot do is often part of the overall you know, view of my art that I want to do to a lot of folks. And so I would argue that those things are integral to a work in many, many cases, not every case, but in many cases they are integral to the work. And it, you know, this is, for example, one of the things that was always talked about in the space between being different between punks and apes. The dirty little secret is that probably neither was actually ever going to be enforced. Neither license was ever going to be enforced for reasons that I just said. But this was, you know, it became integral to the art of the Bored Apes community, the fact that this had commercial rights in theory. And so, you know, the worst thing that could happen is essentially if you had told a bunch of community that they have this thing, and then a court say, no, actually, no one really agreed to that. So we're just going to apply a legal default here. And the legal default here is that your community doesn't have those things, then, you know, that's not a great outcome for everyone in theory.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, because if an artist creates something, they have some particular action in mind that they want to do with their art. So if someone does something completely different, then it hurts them a lot, because it could be something they've been doing all their life to just destroy it potentially.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, so one of the things that is very integral to artists is what they call moral rights. So moral rights in art are essentially the ability to, it's a nuclear option for an artist, but essentially it says an artist can claim that they no longer are the creator of a particular work. And so there are instances where, for example, Picasso hated certain paintings long after, and he just claimed moral rights and said those aren't Picasso's anymore. Now, and that, you know, that affected the tradability within Christie's and Sotheby's of those pieces of work. And there are other famous stories about this, like where a couple is getting divorced and you know, the non-artist of the couple gets some particular paintings. And then the artist side like says, no, I wasn't the artist of those things anymore, and therefore trying to render them useless so that their ex-partner cannot get the benefit on the secondary market of selling those things. And so, you know, how this all works together and how these all pieces together fit together in a decentralized blockchain world, we don't know. But it is, you know, we should consider how we can give artists and creators things that they would otherwise expect to be given, and in a solution, in a package of solutions that is acceptable in a decentralized world.
All right, and you mainly talk about artists, but obviously NFTs have way more use cases than that. So yeah. I'm just thinking, is there any particular industry that you think will unlock the possibility of using NFTs because of the solving legal issue problem? Like, let's say, I don't know, real estate or something like that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of open possibilities right now. You have gaming, which I think is probably in the lead currently. From being able to really mainstream NFT technology across a number of dimensions, and of which legal is a thing that helps tick the box that gets even more folks comfortable entering the space. It's not the only thing that will unlock like massive appeal here. Don't get me wrong, but it's one of the things that will. Continue to allow more and more folks to enter the space and to take apart and remove a bunch of concerns about the existing systems. Royalties are another one. You know, I mean, across the NFT industry, you know, we need to move away. We need to rethink how royalties work, in my opinion. The whole like voluntary thing, the way that exchanges have built themselves, it all makes it for a real challenge for any creator to enforce its royalties. So this is another area that if we can, as technology providers and platform providers within the NFT space, if we can actually fundamentally solve this, and if we can reach the point where we can look creators in the eyes and say, yeah, we can enforce royalties here, then I think this is another area that we'll start to unlock. But if we're talking about like more generally, what do I think will really unlock the NFT ecosystem to absolutely boom? I'm more convinced by the day that play to earn gaming and blockchain gaming, NFT games, whatever the label is that emerges as being the one, that sector is what's going to drive like massive commercial success very, very quickly here. I think it's really clear to me anyway.
I mean, yeah, it makes sense. People already spend a lot of money on games like Fortnite, CSGO and others. So why won't they buy something that they can own and have in their wallet, for example?
Exactly.
And
I would like to know, what fascinates you the most about the NFT technology?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, it's dumb technology as a technology. So nothing fascinates me about the technology. I've been building blockchain systems since 2013. I built the very first permission blockchain. I've been building smart contracts since before Solidity existed. Like, I can see into the technology like with the eyes of quite a few years experience at this point. So about the technology itself, nothing fascinates me. But what does fascinate me is two things. And these are more cultural than anything. First off, when I get a chance to just be a legal nerd and to think about things with my old lawyer and programmer hat on rather than my current hat, I'm very fascinated with the idea of when you purchase an NFT, that is for the first time in probably a long time, that's a genuinely new transaction type that has elements of a licensing transaction, but it's not like licensing software. It's not like you're running a Microsoft Word on your computer in which you have a license to do that from Microsoft. And when you bought the box, that had Word in it or whatever the case might be, essentially what you did was you were purchasing a license. And it's not that. And it's not buying a good or like something that's like a tangible in terms of a pen. So there was a small contract that existed when I bought this pen between whatever the store was and myself. And so it's not that either. And it's not aspects of a ticketing system. So it's not any of those things, but it has aspects of all three of those things. And so for me, the idea of the purchasing of an NFT as being something actually new, genuinely new in terms of a legal transaction type is very fascinating to me when I put my sort of nerd hat on. And the other thing that just really fascinates with me is that the idea that we're going to have a little like serial number on a blockchain and then call this an NFT has then blossomed so many sub strands of use cases that we all kind of arbitrarily for some reason lumped together under this one technology also kind of makes me fascinated more from a cultural perspective than anything else. Because a fine art project versus a PFP project versus a P2E project versus a land project, like those are all so different in so many ways, but yet somehow we like build systems because they're all NFTs to deal with them as a collective. And I just find that on the one hand really cool, and then on the other hand just a bit awkward. So that those are the two things that I find really interesting about the space.
And you said one thing that I really think about: what could be improved in terms of technology when it comes to NFTs? Because I said the technology doesn't fascinate you, so do you see a way that it emerges to something that is, you're like, wow, that's incredible?
I mean, it's a little serial number on a blockchain. It's not that, you know, that we can trade around. So it's not, I mean, what will fascinate me is what we do with the little serial numbers on the blockchain. But to me, that's not like NFT technology. That's technology around NFTs. So I view it slightly differently. If we're talking about like, I want to agree to this thing, and I'm going to have a little facial recognition app on my phone, and then that's going to unlock experiences that I can buy on the secondary market or sell in the secondary market, and some of those will be digital and some of those will be real world, and I'm gonna get merch and all these things. Like, it's cool, but this is all, to me at least, technology sort of around around NFTs rather than the core bit of NFTs. Like the core bit of NFTs, we need to functionally solve a couple more problems on top of the few that I've talked about before. And then I think the technology will just kind of fade away. Like it'll be really solid. I think we need to make sure that we continue to be able to assert availability of the off-chain bit of an NFT. Number one. And then number two, I really do think that the other thing that needs to get solved is around this idea of royalties assurance, which means that we need to bring more kind of exchange mechanics into the NFT smart contract standards. But if we were able to, as an ecosystem, solve those two, then I think NFT technology is just like, it'll be really solid. It'll do what users need it to do. If we solve those two on top of the other ones that I mentioned today, those are the big problems. And then everything becomes really fascinating, because at that point we have the baseline to do, you know, mortgage your sandbox land to build this game, and then I'll have all these technologies around the game that'll be really interesting, and we're going to have a AAA game, and it'll be whatever we want to do. You can integrate in real world components, you can do all kinds of different things there. The base core NFT technology will at that point, in my opinion, be really solid to address all of these use cases.
Yeah. I see time is already running away, Casey.
I tend to do that because I drone on. When you say you have a long podcast, then I get to sit back and chat a little bit. I like it, but then time goes away from me. Sorry.
But it's good for us. We love our guests speaking. Like, this is why we invited you, so it's all good.
Yeah, just before we come to the end of the podcast, is there like would you like to share like one advice or something you want to give to the majority of current users of the NFT space and maybe creators, something they don't know yet and you want to give out to them?
Yeah, I just want to say that it is. I just want to say that I'm thankful to every creator and collector that has turned NFTs into really being a thing. I mean, the last 12 months, in the whole history that I've been involved in this space since 2013, the last 12 months have been by far the most interesting. And so I think that what I would leave everybody with is just an utter fascination that if you've gotten in the last 12 months, thanks. And number one, and number two, you have arrived at a really, really cool time. So just linger there and make sure that you, understand that there's problems, you know, like, but things are getting fixed and things will get fixed, and the problems, you know, will get solved if they're big enough commercial problems. They'll always get solved. So we can talk about problems, but what I would leave everyone that was a collector or a creator with is just thanks for being here and thanks for making the last 12 months awesome. And let's hope the next 12 months are even more interesting and awesome.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. Do you have any last words you want to get out also in terms of Aspen and Aspen's launch?
Yeah, so Aspen will launch in the end of April. Like I said, it will be the very first secondary marketplace that you can go to and provide a single view on all of your PDE assets across different marketplaces, across different chains, across different projects. You can do things like stake, unstake, buy, sell, etc., all in one place. And so it'll be a kind of a unifying interface that we hope a lot from the PDE side of the world will find very, very helpful. So look for that and more information to come on that towards the end of April when we launch.
Where can we find you? Where can we? When can the users find Aspen?
So you can find us on Twitter. That's the best way. Aspen NFT with one N.
All right. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure to check the description box down below, because I will link all the Aspen links, the Twitter and the Discord down below. Yeah, thank you very much, Casey. Conrad, do you have any last questions?
No, I have no last questions. Thank you, Casey, for being here. We appreciate your time. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.